Hi, this is Aaron Hart on AM 760, Colorado's Progressive Talk. I'm filling in for Jay today, who is under the weather, but will probably be back tomorrow. And our special guest is a Pulitzer Prize winner who I was thinking about inviting when to be on the show when I fill in for Mario Solis a little later this week on Thursday and on Monday and Tuesday next week. But we have him now, so I'm very pleased. David K. Johnston's most recent book is Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. I first met him when he was a New York Times reporter and wrote Perfectly Legal, which was a covert campaign to rig our tax system to benefit the super rich and cheat everybody else. I admire and respect you mightily, and thank you so much for joining us, David K. Johnston. It's good to talk to you again.
Thank you for the kind words, Aaron.
Oh, you're most welcome. Now, I just spoke to a right-winger who said, you know, the Congressional Budget Office hated this stimulus. We've got President Obama coming to Denver today, as you know, to sign the bill. Why did the Congressional Budget Office hate this bill, if it did?
Congressional Budget Office doesn't hate anything.
I know.
It is the nonpartisan operation set up by Congress to evaluate complex and subtle economic issues. But what its report shows, in essence, is that this is not the most effective stimulus that we could have. A third of it is tax cuts, which are not stimulative. Part of the spending is deferred somewhat into the future. And this bill represents the real world of political compromise, and in particular, that our new president has placed such a premium on his hope to create a post-partisan Washington.
I know.
We haven't had for the entire history of the Second American Republic that he was willing to put things in the bill, particularly the business tax cuts, that are a dogma to Republican politicians, or at least conservative Republican politicians, even though the evidence is overwhelming that they do not have any stimulative effect.
But the right-wingers don't mention that when they're mentioning that the Congressional Budget Office disapproved of this.
No, and it's one of the oddities of this that the Republicans in the House all voted against this bill and are all complaining they weren't consulted. There are videotapes, and we'll show you that, in fact, they were consulted about this.
Not only consulted, but given some breaks in it as well.
Well, yes, and the fact that these business breaks were in there. Now, Obama is, I think, pretty much a centrist Democrat, but the fact that these things are in there is being completely ignored, and I think it goes to one of the unfortunate things that's happened in America in the last 40 years. It used to be in Washington that, you know, Democrats and Republicans played cards with each other, caroused with each other, whatever, and instead they have divided into these very fiercely warring camps. The breakdown or the proliferation of news outlets, the breakdown of the sort of hegemony of a handful of news organizations has played a role in this. The gerrymandering of districts that has created extremists on both the right and the left
has certainly played into this.
Absolutely. If the law said that districts had to be drawn to be as evenly divided as possible between D's and R's, we would have a different Congress. We would have a Congress more concerned about ordinary Americans because they would have to be competing at home for votes and not competing for campaign contributions. And, of course, if we were to fundamentally reform the campaign finance system, which is in many ways at the core of all of our economic problems, because those people who heavily finance elections are also those people who have figured out that they can get rich off the largesse of the public treasury, so they're getting rules written that never even make the news, that redistribute income upward to them from the rest of us.
And we've had years and years of this. Not only are they doing this, I mean, you know, the only people that right-wing conservatives currently are worried about are the people who are going to run against them in a primary in their district. So how do we, who may run further to the right, which is the only thing I can figure that explains their churlish and silly behavior lately. But on the other hand, this practice, pattern and practice of rewarding the rich, how does it stop without major consequence? I think that's a question. And also, you know, how do we stop this system in its tracks? I mean, it's going to take a long time, won't it? Or how do you go about it?
Well, we didn't get into this overnight. It took 28 years. It's been a bipartisan situation that got us into this. So, no, we will not get out of this overnight. This is going to take a long time. There are a couple of things that we're not doing. First of all, we're not allowing some of the big banks to fail. Why are we not doing that? In the past, we haven't hesitated to close banks. The FDIC goes in and closes banks all the time. Well, we've allowed banks, a couple of them, to become so big and so entangled in activities that are not banking because of the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act that said that retail banking, that's where you put your paycheck, versus investment banking, which is risky business but very profitable if you're successful, and insurance all had to be separate and unrelated businesses. And, well, the government has been unwilling to say exactly what's going on. I think the evidence suggests that they are concerned that these businesses are so intertangled and intermingled now that to have Wells Fargo or Citigroup or Bank of America fail would be to invite all sorts of unexpected economic consequences. But we need to do that. We need to allow businesses to fail. We need to, you know, the Constitution has bankruptcy in it. And one of the reasons America prospered and has done so well is that we have bankruptcy, which allows you to clear the decks and go forward.
Yeah, well, they did something similar with the savings and loan crisis, didn't they? I mean, they allowed the Resolution Trust Corporation, allowed them to fail, and then they came back.
Exactly right. What happened here is that the parent companies went into bankruptcy, and the regulated entities, the savings and loans, were taken over by a federal agency. Now, it still was very costly to taxpayers, and the government sold assets afterwards, and in some cases, we know, remarkable bargains. People paid a penny on the dollar for the real value of these assets. And that should trouble us about what's going on now. But we need to allow businesses to fail. Unfortunately, in 1994, Congress passed a law that's a big player in this and very little covered in the press. Up until 1994, if you as an individual filed for bankruptcy, the bankruptcy judge not only could rewrite your credit card debts or wipe them out and your car loan and perhaps say, gee, your car's only worth $5,000, you have a $7,000 loan, I'm reducing the balance on your loan to $5,000.
Right.
But they could do it with mortgages.
Yes.
And in 1994, Congress took this away. And given the demonization of judges by Republicans, these arguments that we have judicial activism, from the right and the left, it's part of what judges do. Given this demonization, it's highly unlikely we're going to see Congress do something that would be simple and effective.
Which is better than foreclosure, isn't it? I mean, to salvage loans and car loans and house loans than to let them just tank?
Yes, and for several reasons, including you only have to have in a neighborhood of a couple hundred homes, a few percentage points of homes, 3 per 100 or so, fall into foreclosure to begin running the risk that your whole neighborhood will go downhill. And by the way, if there are foreclosed homes in your neighborhoods, organize your neighbors, go cut the lawn, trim the hedges. Yes, you shouldn't have to do that, but you know what? If you don't do it, your housing value will continue to fall.
Yep.
Teenagers will discover these houses for places for parties. People will come in and steal things from the interior of them. It's in your own self-interest to undertake community efforts to protect your neighborhood. But absolutely, we need to allow the rewriting of these mortgages. You know, there's one of the savings and loans in Southern California that I'm told by a friend of mine who's a banking journalist has been doing this. They're a healthy bank. And in every case where they have taken loans that they made and written them down to what their computer model shows is the real value of the loan today,
right?
They've had no re-institutions of actions to foreclose.
Because people would much rather hold on to their homes.
They'd not ruin their credit, and the bank takes the loss because the bank made loans they shouldn't have made. That doesn't mean some people weren't gaming the system, but overwhelmingly it was the institutions that saw profit in this that did this, particularly the investment banks on Wall Street that created the means to finance loans and to separate risk from responsibility. You know, risk we always talk about goes with reward.
Right.
But risk also goes with responsibility. And what Congress did in a series of laws, starting with that 1994 law and the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act and the removal of replacement of old regulations with new ones, was to separate risk from responsibility. And the result of that is obvious at this point. Some of us have been warning about it for years and years, and we're, of course, mocked.
Enron, you know, and you look at all of it, and you're thinking, they made this stuff up out of whole cloth. They were selling stuff that wasn't there.
That's exactly what they did, and they artificially inflated the price of all sorts of assets. Mm-hmm. And all of us are going to suffer because of this, all of us. There is no escaping that we're all going to suffer, but we ought to be trying to fix the institutional problems, number one. Number two, we need to see to it that we minimize the damage as much as possible. That should be our concern. And I have to tell you, in this bill, Aaron, I'm very surprised that President Obama put in the tax cut provisions and other things the Republicans wanted. At least two of them I see now are claiming credit for the bill they voted against. Because think what would have happened under the Senate filibuster rules if they had not adopted the tactic they had. If the president had said, this is my bill, it's laser-focused on jobs, and the Republicans in the Senate had called a filibuster. Can you imagine?
On jobs. On jobs.
Right. He would have been flying to Denver today to say, well, ladies and gentlemen, you want to know why people don't have jobs? Because the Republicans are filibustering in the Senate and playing games. I mean, I think that's a political contest he would have won so easily. And so one of the things I've been worried about and have written in my column and tax notes about in the Columbia Journalism Review and elsewhere is whether the president is being much too timid, not being a courageous leader, but a timid leader.
Oh, you think? I'm hoping not.
Well, so far, he seems to me to be quite timid. Now, there is another way to look at this, which is by bending over backwards and going way beyond anything reasonable to accommodate the troglodyte elements in the Republican Party,
right.
Mitch McConnell.
Right.
He may also
John Boehner.
Yeah, he may be just cutting the rug out from under.
See, that's what I think is happening, because I agree with him. I think that he is an eternal. I think his quote to the Washington Post that he's an eternal optimist, but he's no sap, is probably pretty accurate. I think one of the things that I think he's doing and is he is paying attention to the middle of the country where many people live and that he won a good deal of in this last election, where he's saying, look, I bent over backwards. I was incredibly fair. I even gave them something they wanted before they even asked for it in order to try to gain their support. And look what they did. They vote against it in huge numbers. They won't even talk to me. I could only get three people in the Senate. Now, do you really want these people to be on board? And I think he's doing that in advance of health care reform, in advance of the extra money. He's going to have to shore up those banks somehow, whether he allows them to fail and sets partially nationalizes them through a resolution trust or, you know, corporation or whatever has to happen, as you say. I think he's prepping the ground for other things he's going to have to do. I hope, anyway, that that's the case. I hope these are the opening moves in a strategic chess game. David?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Let me see just one of the things people should think about, Aaron.
Please.
The auto industry is now up against the wall here. And one of the lies being told is that it costs $73 an hour for auto workers at UAW plants and $48 an hour at non-union plants.
Wow.
Not true. $49 an hour at UAW plants. That other cost is where the automobile companies were allowed by Congress, and they had to go to Congress to get permission to do this, to not properly fund their pension and other obligations. And they had to ask for permission to do this. Now, the fact is that something's going to have to change, and the taxpayers may have to pick up the cost of the retirees or a combination of them, but that's simply not a true argument. When you compare apples to apples, UAW workers make $1 an hour more than in wages and benefits than workers do at the other plants, and we know that the UAW workers tend to be, from some studies that have been done, tend to be a little more productive.
Okay, so let me just, because we're running out of time for our segment here, let me just recap what you said. You said fix the institutions, minimize the damage, and go after the Republicans, play hardball with the Republicans, fix the car industry. What else do you recommend quickly? And then we do have to push
bankrupts. Well, you know, let some of these institutions go bankrupt. Give bankruptcy judges the right to rewrite contracts, and get rid of employer-based health care. It is one of the key issues that is driving our economy into the ground. Take it off the books of employers and put it on the books of society like every other modern country.
Single payer.
It's single payer or not, you don't have to do it as single payer, but get it on the books of society and off the books of employers.
obviously, we have a lot more to talk about you, so maybe I will rebook you on Mario's show as well. Thank you very much, David K. Johnson. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you so much. He's the author of his latest book, Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bull. Let's get those bankruptcy judges to work for a living. Let's have them rewrite those mortgages and loans and help people out. I like his ideas. It's 2:21. I mean, it's 21 past the hour. I'm Erin Hart, filling in on the Jay Marvin Show. And we'll be right back with more of your comments and more guests coming right up. Michael Huttner of Progress Now is coming up after John Turk with Progressive Traffic on AM 760, Colorado's Progressive Talk. Hi, this is Erin Hart filling in for Jay Marvin on AM 760, Colorado's Progressive Talk. And Progress Now Colorado is going to host a gathering of progressives in downtown Denver to thank the president. That would be Barack Obama. I can't say that enough. And Colorado's congressional delegation for their work on this historic STEM bill. Everyone's calling it the STEM bill. I guess I will, too. Michael Huttner, executive director, thank you so much for joining us. So what's going on? I know you're just a little disappointed by some of the cuts that were ultimately made to the bill, but this will create 60,000 new jobs in Colorado, right, according to the DEP?
That's right. I think that's both create and save. There was already projections that there were going to be tens of thousands of more jobs lost in this calendar year. So it's not only does it create jobs, but it saves further, cuts further job losses. Today we're going to have at from 4 to 5:30. We're inviting the public to join us, all your listeners. We're going to have Senator Bennett's going to be joining us and other electeds.
Our new Senator, Michael Bennett, yep.
Yeah, he'll be at from 4 to 5:30 at Hamburger Mary's, which is at 700 East, I think it's 600 or 700 East 17th.
And 17th.
And we are right just a few blocks to the it's in the north and to the east of the Capitol there on 17th Avenue. And he'll be making some comments. And we're asking people to come out and actually for what celebrate some legislation that are for a change that our president passes rather than protesting it.
Well, the American Recovery and Investment Act may not be perfect, but it certainly is a change, particularly for urban America, where many of our jobs are located. I mean, the bulk of them are. So I think this will help in many ways. But on the show this morning, we've also been discussing the wisdom of some of the things that are in the bill, like tax breaks and such. Were those the parts of the bills that you didn't like, or what was your?
It was this was an omnibus bill. I think the important part to remember is it's not going to be there's things that we've had concerns about, but overall, we needed to do something and something big to turn this economy around. We've run up the deficit under Bush and the Republican leadership for years, and just last year we had literally somewhere along the neighborhood of 10,000 jobs a quarter lost in Colorado specifically. So the legislation I don't think is perfect. It did get some bipartisan support in the Senate. And I think the important thing to remember is that this is the first step. This isn't going to be a cure-all, and the economy is not going to be turned around in a few months.
Do you think that this is the start of I think Barack Obama bent over backwards to please the Republicans. I was just talking to David K. Johnson, and I don't know if you heard part of that interview. But he's worried that Barack Obama is being a little wimpy. I think he's actually playing the long-term game. I think he's playing a long-term game of chess. And his opening moves was, here, I'll be nice, I'll play well, and then it's going to be like, okay, look, here's the thing. We need to do this for the American people. You want to filibuster against jobs? Go right ahead.
That's right. And he had to start with the economy. There was no question. I think there was a lot of criticism when Clinton first started, that he did other things that weren't mainstream, like, even though we may have supported him, like the whole, gays in the military. This time, he tackled the main issue. He got it already passed, and now he's on to tackle other issues that affect jobs, affect economy. That healthcare is going to come up this year.
He's making his mind up about important things like Afghanistan and what to do with that, too, when we have an Islamic State being built inside of Pakistan, a region of Pakistan. We need to think about all these different things. Thank you so much for joining us, Michael Huttner. I hope you have a great time at Hamburger Mary's. I'll be there in spirit.
Thanks, everybody. Join us 4 to 5:30 today. Hamburger Mary's with Senator Bennett and others. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you. And once again, Hamburger Mary's is located at 700 East 17th Avenue. I'm Aaron Hart, filling in on the J. Marvin Show. Time to check in with traffic and John Turk, and then we'll be back with John Nichols of The Nation Magazine. All that and coming up and more. And then we'll check in with Media Matters. And then again, it's just us. By the way, I'll be filling in for Mario on Thursday afternoon, just to let you know, the 19th. I'm Aaron Hart, filling in on Colorado's Progressive Talk. Hi, this is Aaron Hart filling in for Under the Weather J. Marvin. Today he'll probably be back tomorrow. And the nation's Washington correspondent is John Nichols. He's a pioneering political blogger. He's a contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times. He also is the author of an upcoming book, The Genesis of Impeachment. Thank you for joining us, John Nichols. A pleasure to talk to you.
Aaron, it's great to be on with you, and you're where the action is today.
Yeah, I sure am. The president's coming to down. The progressives are partying. The right-wing conservatives are talking about protesting. I don't know how successful they'll be, but we're alive today, man. It's exciting.
They're not so good at protesting, to be honest, because no. You know, they tend to be old and crotchety, and it's hard to get them out. But
well, and marching in lockstep really kind of makes you fall down, doesn't it?
You know, it really kind of defeats the purpose. Yeah, you know, when you're marching in lockstep, especially if it's tight quarters, you end up kicking the person in front of you. Yeah,
so, or kicking yourself.
No, I think it's a big deal that Obama's coming to Denver. It speaks volumes about what is going on in his head. And he knows full well that the first really major statement about what he was going to do as regards to the economy came in that acceptance speech at the stadium there. You know, Obama was nominated, frankly, as an anti-war candidate.
Exactly.
Chose him because he had opposed the war when Hillary Clinton had not. Once he got the nomination, however, he realized, in fact, he knew as the process went on, that it was going to be an election not about the war, but about the economy. And that address in Denver was really the start of his appeal on economic issues. So he's returning because you've come full circle. He was elected president. He has produced a stimulus package along with Congress. It's not a perfect package, but it is one of those rare moments in American politics where in relatively short order after an election, someone who made a promise goes back to the place where they made that promise.
And delivers. And not only that, I think he's very smart about this. You know, I was just talking to David K. Johnston, who I'm sure you know of, and he is, of course, he's worried that the president is being a little too wimpy and timid on some of his economic reforms. But you know what? I think he's playing a long game. I think, you know, bending over backwards to bring Republicans into the process was part of a long-term strategy, because he knows he's going to have to tackle health care. He knows he's going to have to tackle more about the economy. The banks are certainly in straits. So is the car industry. I mean, there's more to come, isn't there, John?
Well, yeah, I think what I try to do is reconcile you and David and suggest that David's right, that the president has been a bit more compromising.
Timid,
and cautious.
I think, is the word he used.
Those are appropriate words. But you're also right about the long game. And what I think is going on here is that Barack Obama is doing two things. First off, he's communicating to the American people that he is perfectly willing to work with Republicans, that there's, you know, this isn't some sort of partisan jihad. That's an important message. America wants that. But secondly, he's also learning, and he's getting a feel for what the Republicans are going to be willing to do. And I have to say that the lesson from the stimulus fight is a pretty unsettling one. There's very little evidence that they're willing to help in any way. And I would go a step further. I would say that the role of Arlen Specter, Susan Collins, and Olympia Snowe, the three Republicans who negotiated a deal in the Senate on the stimulus bill, was severely damaging. And I emphasize severely damaging to the process, because they forced in a whole bunch of tax cuts that are not going to do anything to stimulate the economy.
Nothing. Yeah.
What's going to happen is the federal government is going to borrow Understand this. Federal government is going to borrow roughly $300 billion, $300 billion to give tax cuts that will lock up money in places that are non-stimulative. So
from whom are we going to borrow? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but from whom are we going to borrow, John Nichols?
You. You're going to have to pay for it.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
You know, and your kids,
I didn't think the Chinese.
No.
Yeah.
The Chinese are in crisis, too.
I know.
And so this is the really ugly thing. We should be doing stimulus bills. We should be spending money. There's simply no question. Every economist, right-wing economists, say that's a good idea. But nobody thinks that you should be borrowing money to give tax cuts that they're not going to be stimulative at all. And so this is why I say that I think Obama is in a process of learning. He tried to work with the Republicans. Senate Democrats tried to work with the Republicans. They ended up with something that's actually damaging in some ways. It takes us in a situation, what I would suggest, you imagine somebody's drowning and they don't know how to swim. And they're 10 feet out, and you throw them 6 feet of rope. I mean, that's what they did. We had a stimulus plan passed by the House that was 10 feet of rope.
I feel myself dog paddling as we speak. How does he get out of it? You say it's a triumph for him to do this, though, and that he's done well so far, I guess, overall.
Yeah, yeah.
How does this stand if it's not going to be helpful? I mean, does he get the blame down the line, or how does this shake out? I know it's unfair to ask you to do it from here.
No,
but
it's not unfair at all. It's absolutely, this is the question we've got to focus on. It's the one he should be focused on. First off, this bill that was passed is a necessary bill. It's going to bail out a lot of state and local governments at a time when they're going to provide critical aid to the unemployed, the underemployed. So, I mean, this is not bad stuff. Right. This is what's going on is good. And it will do some stimulation, just not enough. The reality is the president's going to have to go back and ask for more. I guarantee you this is not the end. And even he says it's the end of the process. It's the beginning. And so I don't think that you see it as any kind of, or I don't think it's wise to see it as any kind of failure. What the way to understand it is that, you know, we made some initial steps. They're reasonably good. They're not as good as we'd like. Now, the fear that I have, and I think this is why Obama's going to have to be a much greater communicator than Ronald Reagan today and throughout the next months and years, is that there will be a huge effort to say, you know, how come you didn't bring it all back right away? I mean, why isn't the economy perfect by April? And, of course, as we know, anybody in their right mind knows, a stimulus package like this doesn't even go into realistic effect for, you know, months, even years. But there will be a spin game going on. Clearly, a lot of congressional Republicans, not the governors. Remember, the Republican governors are
they love him lately. They can't wait to stand next to him at his campaign events. Charlie Frist practically tripped over himself to get in the photo.
Alan Schwarzenegger, you know, knows that this is the only thing that's going to save California.
Come to California.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So it's what really is going on here is congressional Republicans have made a calculus that the only way they could possibly get back to power quickly is by creating the impression that Obama has failed. And so he's going to have a battle there, and it's going to be what really most economic battles are about, and that is people's confidence level, the
perception.
Extent to which they believe we're going the right direction. And Obama will have to channel a little bit of Franklin Roosevelt and say, look, I know it's hard, but we're taking the right steps, we're doing the right things, and in time, in a relatively, hopefully short amount of time, we're going to start to feel a little less pain. Now, that's a hard message. It's not a fun message, but
certainly,
it's an important one.
Well, and I think a start of this, perhaps, and I was sorry that Judd Gregg sort of blasted it out of the water, when he gave that speech on Lincoln's birthday, the Lincoln celebration in Illinois recently, I thought it was better than his inauguration speech. It was beautiful, and it was lyrical, and it was also a very poetic explanation of why government can work and why it's important and why it's one of our treasures as a people. And, you know, he's got to contradict a huge tidal wave of anti-government propaganda that's been in place certainly since Ronald Reagan, and Nixon wasn't too fond of government either, even though he created a lot of agencies himself. So I think he's got some anti-propaganda work to do, and I agree with you. Now, so should he institute the modern-day equivalent of the YouTube fireside chat?
You betcha. In fact, he's already doing it. The truth is he's doing his Saturday statements on YouTube. And I, you know, the person that I'd reference here, who I think is an important, you know, at least grounding for how to do this, is Rudy Giuliani. Remember, love him or hate him, in the aftermath of September 11th, on September 11th and September 12th, 2001,
yep.
Rudy Giuliani couldn't personally do anything about the trauma to the country. Or to New York. There's very little that he could personally do, except as a known face, keep communicating information.
America's mayor.
He was constantly available to keep, you know, saying, look, here's where we are, here's what's happened, here's what we're trying to do. And as long as people saw him, they felt a relatively high level of confidence that it was going to be, if not okay, at least reasonable, that some good was going to come of this, that somehow we were going to sort it out. And I think that that's Obama's job, because I will tell you, Aaron, and I'm not kidding about this, this economic crisis
is serious.
Is far more severe and far more sweeping than anything this country's been hit by militarily or politically in a long time. And so Obama is going to have to be an equivalent of Giuliani for weeks, months, perhaps years, and that's okay. That's why I think that's one of the main reasons we elected him president, was because we thought, and I think it was right, that he's a very good communicator.
He's a very good communicator, and he's also a very calm, centered person. You know, I think that that's part of it, is he exudes that confidence and self-confidence I think that the nation needs to feel again. So I agree with you. We'll look forward to seeing your columns in The Nation and your correspondence from Washington in The Nation to further track his progress. Quick word, where do you think he goes? Obviously, he goes to Arizona from here to talk about mortgage foreclosures, and then he goes to Canada. What should his next move be, do you think, legislatively, as Washington's correspondent for The Nation, John?
Yeah, I think that the president's next move is, and he's going to be talking about it in Arizona, this mortgage crisis has not begun to be addressed. And what we're unfortunately looking at is the reality that tens, maybe dozens of banks are going to fail in very short order. The fact is the federal government's going to have to take over some of these banks, clean out the toxic assets, and then probably move them back to the private sector. But that's going to be a big, bold, very tough process, and Obama's going to have to get into it tomorrow. That's the reality. There's no rest here.
Well, I think we have to look at it as we're getting into it. You know, in some ways, we took our country back, and now we've got to take responsibility for it, too, as taxpayers, as citizens.
Yeah, we thought we were just passing off the responsibility. Now we find out we have a big responsibility ourselves. And it's true.
I agree. John Nichols, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you so much.
A delight, dear. Take care.
Okay, I'm Aaron Hart, filling in for Jay Marvin. The Nation's Washington correspondent, John Nichols. Read his work. It's really most excellent, and you learn something new every day, and I just learned a lot. How about you? It's 48 past the hour. I'm Aaron Hart, filling in for Jay Marvin. Coming up, we'll have Carl Frisch from Media Matters, but we've got a few minutes amongst ourselves. So, what do you think Barack Obama's next move is? What would you tell him? As you know, he's coming to Denver today. Are you excited? I am. 303-713-7600. This is the Aaron Hart version of the Jay Marvin Show. Stand by for traffic with John Turk. Hi, this is Aaron Hart filling in for Jay Marvin. Love to have you join us. Carl Frisch is coming up for Media Matters, and then it's all us for the rest of the show. I'll be back on Thursday afternoon to fill in for Mario Solis, who's taking a little bit of time off, and I'm also filling in for him on Monday and Tuesday afternoon drive. Check out AaronHartShow.com for further details. Good morning, Rob in Lakewood. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Aaron. I always enjoy when you fill in.
Thank you.
I just want to say I'm very excited today. It's a beautiful day here in Denver for a wonderful new president to be here. And while us hardworking liberals and progressives are making our paychecks, country clubs all over Denver are filled with geriatrics and pancake breakfast walkers and brown orthopedic shoes.
Yeah, it's a hard time these days. You know, I'm clipping coupons. I like saving money, let's put it that way, even in fat times. But you know what? I'm clipping more coupons than I ever have, and I'm eating out less than I ever have, I think.
Yeah, I wonder how many of them, it's like their own version of tailgating before they do their own version of protesting.
I don't know. I mean, the right-wing Republicans, I find it really interesting. I don't know. I said earlier that they've become the grand old Southern white party, but they really, I mean, what is this, the grand old Confederate flag right back flying again? I mean, I love it every time Boehner talks into his neck, you know. What's his name?
It's spelled Boehner. How do you get a Boehner out of that?
I don't know, but he calls himself Boehner. But, you know, when he does it, Chris Matthews was one who pointed that out to me. He talks in his neck so he can talk even deeper, so I've been trying it all morning periodically. I guess you do talk a little deeper when you talk into your neck. I don't know. I'm going to use it for voiceovers now.
Well, you have a wonderful day, Aaron.
Thank you very much, Rob. I appreciate it. Talk like John Boehner. Maybe I'll get more She Who Must Be Obeyed assignments. All right, we have emails, too, to catch you up with. I'm amazed at these Republican supporters who think that Republicans know how to create jobs. I guess they just didn't want to offer them jobs until now. What a joke Bush followers still are. Have a great, great day. Thank you, Vicki, and many of you are being quite encouraging about me as a talk show host on Facebook. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate your work, too. You know, we've discussed, and many of you also can go to the Facebook now and join me. I'm not on Twitter this morning. I'm going to attempt Twitter and doing the Mario Solis show. We'll see. Afternoon Drive is Afternoon Drive, so priority is always you. Coming up, we'll talk to Carl Frisch of Media Matters about all that misinformation those white wingers have been feeding us. And I'm going to attempt to talk in my neck again. It's 303-713-7600. This is the Aaron Hart version of the J. Marvin Show, always making fun of John Boehner.